Good evening, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Tom Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now, and will be easier to solve while rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go and drifting into sleep. Before we get on with the show, I'd like to take a couple of minutes to ask for a little bit of support. If you are finding Sleepy Tom Tales helpful and you would like to support it, to help me keep it ad-free and going out to thousands of insomniacs just like you, please consider signing up on Patreon. That's patreon.com/sleepytomtales. This is a monthly support that not only helps me keep the lights on, but can get you fun bonuses. From as little as $2 a month, you get weekly access to early release on the main episodes, so that you get your fresh sleep aid on a Wednesday instead of a Sunday. And $5 gets you weekly bonus mini-sodes, special edits, and a monthly mega-sode, which is all the month's releases in one big listen. The most recent member of the Patreon family is Chuck, who signed up recently. Thanks very much for the support, Chuck. He's made some very good suggestions that I'm going to put some thought into going forward. And welcome to the team. And as always, if you sign up at Patreon, or even just if you listen, I'm always open to suggestions and requests as well. But also, if monthly support seems a big ask, you can make once-off tips through buymeacoffee.com/sleepytomtales, or the tip jar on the website. I've also got some basic merchandise in a TeePublic store, which you can reach through the show notes, or via the website sleepytomtales.net. And another huge way to help the show, without having to reach into your pockets, as helpful as money is, after all, it's how you pay for things, even arguably more important is just spreading the word. If you tell people about the show, if you know someone who's struggling to sleep, you can help me in my mission to give more people a good night's sleep. So you can help me to do our small part to improve people's lives. Of course, if you tell people on social media, make sure to tag me in. That's at Sleepy Tom Tales on Instagram or Twitter, so I can see and I can thank you. Last but not least, of course, I got to shout out the music, which is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiku. The music is available on their website at loyaltyfreakmusic.com. And that's enough of that. Let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Tom Tales? What is it for? What is this strange idea, this podcast that you're supposed to fall asleep to? But lack of sleep is a health crisis in the 21st century, and this is a podcast that is intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Tom Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night, or maybe sometimes background noise or company. That's why I make these episodes quite long, so that I'm here for you, without any pressure of the end coming. Now, as far as I know, there are a couple of different ways to engage with the show. The main idea is that it gives you something to focus on, a story or an event that lets you keep your mind on a specific point, to stop it from spinning out into stress and anxieties, to focus just enough not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep when it comes for you. But there may be a second way. Maybe you're someone that just needs something in the background. These days, people sometimes just like white noise, or the sound of the ocean, or the wind in the trees. Or maybe some boring dude just droning on in the background. What matters though is you don't try to force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on the thread of the story and allow the need for sleep to come for you. Now I'm hopeful that you'll be asleep before I get to the end of the episode, but it's important not to feel pressurized. It may not work on the first night. It'll probably take a few nights for you to get used to listening to my voice. Maybe my accent is strange to you. Or maybe early on at least one episode just isn't long enough. Or maybe your problem isn't so much falling asleep. Maybe you fall asleep all right and you wake up in the middle of the night. What I recommend is to let the podcast run all night. The best thing to do is download a whole bunch of episodes into your podcatcher of choice, put them in a playlist. When you go to sleep, start with the latest and let them go. That way, if you wake up and find yourself staring at the ceiling at 3 a.m., you can just pop your earbuds back in and allow yourself to go straight back to sleep again. Or maybe you even wake up a little bit before your alarm, 60 minutes or even 30 minutes. What I recommend in that case is the same thing as if it was 3 a.m. Carry on listening and go right back to sleep again. And you may want to say, Dave, what is the point of that? What good is an extra 30 minutes of sleep to me? But I can tell you now that I find it very useful, and I've had people thank me for making this recommendation. Because there's something about allowing yourself complete relaxation right before the alarm that's satisfying on a whole new level. But whether it's first thing at night, middle of the night, late in the morning, the important thing is that you try to relax. If you're new to the show and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this will probably seem strange to you. So give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you. To create a safe space. A cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. This week, we return to The Elements of Geology by William Harmon Norton. The Mantle of Rock Waste. We have seen that rocks everywhere slowly wasting away. They are broken in pieces by frost, by tree roots, and by heat and cold. They dissolve and decompose under the chemical action of water and the various corrosive substances which it contains, leaving their insoluble residues as residual clays and sands upon the surface. As a result, there is everywhere forming a mantle of rock waste which covers the land. It is well to imagine how the country would appear were this mantle with its soil and vegetation all scraped away, or had it never been formed. The surface of the land would then be everywhere of bare rock, as unbroken as a quarry floor. The thickness of the mantle. In any locality, the thickness of the mantle of rock waste depends as much on the rate at which it is constantly being removed as on the rate at which it is forming. On the face of cliffs, it is absent, for here, waste is removed as fast as it is made. Where waste is carried away more slowly than it is produced, and accumulates in time to great depth. The granite of Pike's Peak is disintegrated to a depth of 20 feet. In the city of Washington, granite rock is so softened to a depth of 80 feet that it can be removed with a pick and shovel. About Atlanta, Georgia, the rocks are completely rotted for 100 feet from the surface, while the beginnings of decay may be noticed at thrice that depth. In places in southern Brazil, the rock is decomposed to a depth of 400 feet. In southwestern Wisconsin, a reddish residual clay has an average depth of 13 feet on broad uplands, where it has been removed to the least extent. The country rock on which it rests is a limestone with about 10% of insoluble impurities. At least how thick then was that portion of the limestone which has rotted down to the clay? Distinguishing characteristics of residual waste. We must learn to distinguish waste formed in places by the action of the weather from the products of other geological agencies. Residual waste is unstratified. It contains no substances which have not been derived from the weathering of the parent rock. There is a gradual transition from residual waste into the unweathered rock beneath. Waste resting on sound rock evidently has been shifted and was not formed in place. In certain regions of southern Missouri, the land is covered with a layer of broken flints and red clay, while the country rock is limestone. The limestone contains nodules of flint, and we may infer that it has been by the decay and removal of thick masses of limestone that the residual layer of clay and flints has been left upon the surface. Flint is a form of quartz, dull-lustered, usually grey or blackish in colour and opaque, except on thinnest edges, where it is translucent. Over much of the northern states, there is spread an unstratified stony clay called the drift. It often rests on sound rocks. It contains grains of sand, pebbles, and boulders composed of many different minerals, and rocks that the country rock cannot furnish. Hence the drift cannot have been formed by the decay of the rock of the region. A shale or limestone, for example, cannot waste to a clay containing granite pebbles. The origin of the drift will be explained in subsequent chapters. The differences in rocks are due more to their soluble than to their insoluble constituents. The latter are few in number and are much the same in rocks of widely different nature, being chiefly quartz, silicates of alumina, and iron oxide. By the removal of their soluble parts, very many and widely different rocks rot down to a residual clay, gritty with particles of quartz, and colored red or yellow with iron oxide. In a broad way, the changes which rocks undergo in weathering are an adaptation to the environment in which they find themselves at the Earth's surface. An environment different from that in which they were formed under sea or underground. In open air, where they are attacked by various destructive elements, few of the rock-making minerals are stable compounds, except quartz, the iron oxides, and the silicates of alumina. And so it is to one or more of these comparatively insoluble substances that most rocks are reduced by long decay. The soil. The same agencies which produce the mantle of waste are continually at work upon it, breaking it up into finer and finer particles, and causing its more complete decay. Thus, on the surface where the waste is weathered longest, it is gradually made fine enough to support the growth of plants, and is then known as soil. The coarser waste beneath is sometimes spoken of as subsoil. Soil usually contains more or less dark, carbonaceous, decaying organic matter, called humus, and is then often termed the humus layer. Soil forms not only on waste produced in place from the rock beneath, but also on materials which have been transported, such as sheets of glacial drift and river deposits. Until rocks are reduced to residual clays, the work of the weather is more rapid and effective on the fragments of the mantle of waste than on the rocks from which the waste is being formed. Why? Any fresh excavation of cellar or cistern, or cut for road or railway, will show the characteristics of the humus layer. It may form only a grey film on the surface, or we may find it in a layer a foot or more thick, dark or even black above, and growing gradually lighter in colour as it passes by insensible gradations into the subsoil. In some way, the decaying vegetable matter continually forming on the surface has become mingled with the material beneath it. How humus and the subsoil are mingled. The mingling of humus in the subsoil is brought about by several means. The roots of plants penetrate the waste, and when they die, leave the decaying substance to fertilize it. Leaves and stems falling on the surface are turned under by several agents. Earthworms and other animals whose home is in the waste drag them into their burrows either for food or to line their nests. trees overthrown by the wind, roots and all, turn over the soil and subsoil and mingle them together. Bacteria also work in the waste and contribute to its enrichment. The animals living in the mantle do much in other ways toward the making of soil. They bring the coarser fragments from beneath to the surface where the waste weathers more rapidly. Their burrows allow air and water to penetrate the waste more freely and to affect it to greater depths. In the tropics, the mantle of waste is worked over chiefly by ants. They excavate underground galleries and chambers, extending sometimes as much as 14 feet below the surface, and build mounds which may reach as high above it. In some parts of Paraguay and southern Brazil, these mounds, like gigantic potato hills, cover tracts of considerable area. In search for its food, the deadwood of trees, the so-called white ant constructs runways of earth about the size of gas pipes, reaching from the base of the tree to the topmost branches. On the plateaus of Central Africa, explorers have walked for miles through forests, every tree of which was plastered with these galleries of mud. Each grain of earth used in their construction is moistened and cemented by slime, as it is laid in place by the ant, and is thus acted on by organic chemical agents. Sooner or later, these galleries are beaten down by heavy rains, and their fertilizing substances are scattered widely by the wind. In temperate regions, the waste is worked over largely by earthworms. In making their burrows, worms swallow earth in order to extract from it any nutritive organic matter which it may contain. They treat it with their digestive acids, grind it in their stony gizzards, and void it in castings on the surface of the ground. It was estimated by Darwin that in many parts of England each year, on every acre, more than 10 tons of earth passes through the bodies of earthworms and are brought to the surface, and that every few years the entire soil layer is thus worked over by them. In all these ways the waste is made fine and stirred and enriched. Grain by grain the subsoil with its fresh mineral ingredients is brought to the surface, and the rich organic matter which plants and animals have taken from the atmosphere is ploughed under. Thus nature ploughs and harrows on, the great world's farm, to make ready and ever to renew a soil fit for the endless succession of her crops. The world processes by which rocks are continually wasting away are thus indispensable to the life of plants and animals. The organic world is built on the ruins of the inorganic, and because the solid rocks have been broken down into soil, men are able to live upon the earth. The source of the energy which accomplishes all this necessary work is the sun. It is the radiant energy of the sun which causes the disintegration of rocks, which lifts vapor into the atmosphere to fall as rain, which gives life to plants and animals. Considering the earth in a broad way, we may view it as a globe of solid rock, the lithosphere, surrounded by two mobile envelopes, the envelope of air, the atmosphere, and the envelope of water, the hydrosphere. Under the action of solar energy, these envelopes are in constant motion. Water from the hydrosphere is continually rising in vapor into the atmosphere. The air of the atmosphere penetrates the hydrosphere, for its gases are dissolved in all waters. And both air and water enter and work upon the solid earth. By their action upon the lithosphere, they have produced a third envelope, the mantle of rock waste. This envelope also is in movement, not indeed as a whole, but particle by particle. The causes which set its particles in motion, and the different forms which the mantle comes to assume, we will now proceed to study. Movements of the mantle of rock waste. At the sandstone ledges which we first visited, we saw not only that the rocks were crumbling away, but also that grains and fragments of them were creeping down the slopes of the valley to the stream, and were carried by it onward towards the sea. This process is going on everywhere. Slowly, it may be, and with many interruptions, but surely the waste of the land moves downward to the sea. We may divide its course into two parts, the path to the stream, which we will now consider, and its carriage onward by the stream, which we will defer to a later chapter. The chief agent concerning the movement of waste is gravity. Each particle of waste feels the unceasing downward pull of the Earth's mass, and follows it when free to do so. All agencies which produce waste tend to set its particles free and in motion, and therefore cooperate with gravity. On cliffs, rocks fall when wedged off by frost or by roots of trees, and when detached by any other agency. On slopes of waste, water freezes in chinks between stones, and in pores between particles of soil, and wedges them apart. Animals and plants stir the waste, heat expands it, cold contracts it. The strokes of the raindrops drive loose particles down the slope, and the wind lifts and lets them fall. Of all these movements, gravity assists those which are downhill, and retards those which are uphill. On the whole, therefore, the downhill movements prevail, and the mantle of waste, block by block, grain by grain, creeps along the downhill path. A slab of sandstone laid on another of the same kind at an angle of 17 degrees, and left in the open air, was found to creep down the slope at the rate of a little more than a millimeter a month. The most efficient agent in the carriage of waste to the streams is the rain. It moves particles of soil by the force of the blows of the falling drops, and washes them down all slopes to within reach of permanent streams. On surfaces unprotected by vegetation, as on ploughed fields and in arid regions, the rain wears furrows and gullies both in the mantle of waste and exposures of unaltered rock. At the foot of a hill we may find that the soil has accumulated by creep and wash to the depth of several feet, while where the hillside is steepest the soil may be exceedingly thin, or quite absent, because removed about as fast as it formed. Against the walls of an abbey built on a slope in Wales 700 years ago, the creeping waste has gathered on the uphill side to a depth of 7 feet. The slow-flowing sheet of waste is often dammed by fences and walls, whose uphill side gathers waste in a few years, so as to show a distinctly higher surface than the downhill side, especially in ploughed fields, where the movement is least checked by vegetation. At the foot of cliffs there is usually to be found a slope of rock fragments which have clearly fallen from above. Such a heap of waste is known as talus. The amount of talus in any place depends both on the rate of its formation and the rate of its removal. Talus forms rapidly in climates where mechanical disintegration is most effective, where rocks are readily broken into blocks because loosely jointed and thinly bedded rather than massive, and where they are firm enough to be detached in fragments of some size instead of in fine grains. Talus is removed slowly where it decays slowly, either because of the climate or the resistance of the rock. It may be rapidly removed by a stream flowing along its base. In a moist climate, a soluble rock, such as massive limestone, may form talus little if any faster than the talus wears away. A loose textured sandstone breaks down into incoherent sand grains, which in dry climates, where unprotected by vegetation, may be blown away as fast as they fall, leaving the cliff bare to the base. Cliffs of such slow decaying rocks as quartzite and granite, when closely jointed, accumulate talus in large amounts. Talus slopes may be so steep as to reach the angle of repose, i.e. the steepest angle at which the material will lie. This angle varies with different materials, being greater with coarse and angular fragments than with fine rounded grains. Sooner or later, a talus reaches that equilibrium where the amount removed from the surface just equals that supplied from the cliff above. As the talus is removed and weathers away, its slope retreats together with the retreat of the cliff. Where rocks weather faster than their waste is carried away, the waste comes at last to cover all rocky ledges. On the steeper slopes, it is coarser and in more rapid movement than on slopes more gentle. But mountainsides and hills and plains alike come to be mantled with sheets of waste, which everywhere is creeping towards the streams. Such unbroken slopes, worn or built to the least inclination at which the waste supplied by weathering can be urged onward, are known as graded slopes. Of far less importance than the silent, gradual creep of waste, which is going on at all times everywhere about us, are the startling local and spasmodic movements which we are now to describe. Avalanches. On steep mountainsides, the accumulated snows of winter often slip and slide in avalanches to the valleys below. These rushing torrents of snow sweep their tracks clean of waste, and are one of nature's normal methods of moving it along the downhill path. Another common and abrupt method of delivering waste to streams is by slips of the waste mantle in large masses. After long rains and after winter frosts, the cohesion between the waste and the sound rock beneath it is loosened by seeping water underground. The waste slips on the rock surface thus lubricated and plunges down the mountainside in a swift roaring torrent of mud and stones. We may conveniently mention here a second type of landslide, where masses of solid rock, as well as the mantle of waste, are involved in a sudden movement. Such slips occur when valleys have been rapidly deepened by streams or glaciers, and their sides have not yet been graded. A favorable condition is where the strata dip toward the valley or are broken by joint planes dipping in the same direction. The upper layers, including perhaps the entire mountainside, have been cut across by the valley trench and are left supported only on the inclined surface of the underlying rocks. Water may percolate underground along the surface and loosen the cohesion between the upper and underlying strata by converting the upper surface of a shale to a soft wet clay, by dissolving layers of a limestone, or by removing the cement of a sandstone and converting it into loose sand. When the inclined surface is thus lubricated, the overlying masses may be launched into the valley below. The solid rocks are broken and crushed in sliding and converted into waste consisting, like that of talus, of angular, unsorted fragments, blocks of all sizes being mingled pell-mell with rock meal and dust. The principal effects of landslides may be gathered from the following examples. At Gona, India, in 1893, the face of a spur 4,000 feet high of the lower ranges of the Himalayas slipped into the gorge of the headwaters of the Ganges River in successive rock falls which lasted for 3 days. Blocks of stone were projected for a mile, and clouds of limestone dust were spread over the surrounding country. The debris formed a dam 1,000 feet high, extending for 2 miles along the valley. A lake gathered behind this barrier, gradually rising until it overtopped it in a little less than a year. The upper portion of the dam then broke, and a terrific rush of water swept down the valley in a wave, which 20 miles away rose 160 feet in height. A narrow lake is still held by the strong base of the dam. In 1896, after 40 days of incessant rain, a cliff of sandstone slipped into the Yangtze River in China, reducing the width of the channel to 80 yards and causing formidable rapids. At Flims in Switzerland, a prehistoric landslip flung a dam 1,800 feet high across the headwaters of the Rhine. If spread evenly over a surface of 28 square miles, the material would cover it to a depth of 660 feet. The barrier is not yet entirely cut away, and several lakes are held in shallow basins on its hummocky surface. A slide from the precipitous riverfront of the Citadel Hill of Quebec in 1889 dashed across Champlain Street, breaking a number of houses and causing the death of 45 persons. The strata here are composed of steeply dipping slate. In lofty mountain ranges, there may not be a single valley without its trace of landslides. So common there is this method of the movement of waste, and of building to grade over steepened slopes. We are now to consider a few of the forms into which rock masses are carved by the weather. In many quarries and outcrops, we may see that the blocks into which one or more of the uppermost layers have been broken, along their joints and bedding planes, are no longer angular, as are those of the layers below. The edges and corners of these blocks have been worn away by the weather. Such rounded cores, known as boulders of weathering, are often left to strew the surface. Differential weathering. This term covers all cases in which a rock mass weathers differently in different portions. Any weaker spots or layers are etched out on the surface, leaving them more resilient in relief. Thus, limestones become pitted where the weather draws out the weaker portions. In these pits, when once they are formed, moisture gathers, a little soil collects, vegetation takes root, and thus they are further enlarged until the limestone may be deeply honeycombed. On the sides of canyons and elsewhere where the edges of strata are exposed, the harder layers project as cliffs, while the softer weather back to slopes covered with the talus of the harder layers above them. It is convenient to call the former cliff makers and the latter slope makers. Differential weathering plays a large part in the sculpture of the land. Areas of weak rock are wasted to plains, while where areas of hard rock adjacent are still left as hills and mountain ridges, as in the valleys and mountains of eastern Pennsylvania. But in such instances, the lowering of the surface of the weaker rock is also due to the wear of streams, and especially to the removal by them from the land of the waste which covers and protects the rocks beneath. Rocks owe their weakness to several different causes. Some, such as beds of loose sand, are soft and easily worn by rains. Some, as limestone and gypsum, for example, are soluble. Even hard and soluble rocks are weak under the attack of the weather when they are closely divided by joints and bedding planes, and are thus readily broken up into blocks by mechanical agencies. As cliffs retreat under the attack of the weather, portions are left behind where the rock is more resistant, or where the attack, for any reason, is less severe. Such remnant masses, if large, are known as outliers. Monuments are smaller masses, and may be but partially detached from the cliff face. In the breaking down of sheets of horizontal strata, outliers grow smaller and smaller, and are reduced to massive rectangular monuments resembling castles. The rock castle falls into ruin, leaving here and there an isolated tower. The tower crumbles to a lonely pillar, soon to be overthrown. The various and often picturesque shapes of monuments depend on the kind of rock, the attitude of the strata, and the agent by which they are chiefly carved. Thus, pillars may have a capital formed of a resistant stratum. Monuments may be undercut and come to rest on narrow pedestals, wherever the weather more rapidly near the ground. either because of the greater moisture there, or in arid climates, because worn at their base by drifting sands. Stony clays disintegrating under the rain often contain boulders which protect the softer material beneath from the vertical blows of raindrops, and thus come to stand on pedestals of some height. One may sometimes see on the ground beneath dripping eaves pebbles left in the same way, protecting tiny pedestals of sand. Most mountains have been carved out of the great broadly uplifted folds and blocks of the Earth's crust. Running water and glacier ice have cut these folds and blocks into masses divided by deep valleys. But it is by the weather, for the most part, that the masses thus separated have been sculpted to the present forms of the individual peaks and ridges. Frost and heat and cold sculpture high mountains to sharp, tusk-like peaks, and ragged, serrate crests where their waste is readily removed. The Matterhorn of the Alps is a famous example of a mountain peak, whose carving by the frost and other agents is an act of progress. On its face, scarcely a rock anywhere is firmly attached, and the fall of loosened stones is incessant. Mountain climbers who have camped at its base tell how huge rocks from time to time come leaping down its precipices, followed by trains of dislodged smaller fragments and rock dust, and how at night one may trace the course of the boulders by the sparks which they strike from the mountain walls. Mount Assiniboine, Canada, resembles the Matterhorn in form and has been carved by the same agencies. The Needles of Arizona are examples of sharp mountain peaks in a warm, arid region sculpted chiefly by temperature changes. Chemical decay, especially when carried on beneath the cover of waste and vegetation, favors the production of rounded knobs and dome-shaped mountains. We have seen that weathering reduces the angular block quarried by the frost to a rounded boulder by chipping off its corners and smoothing away its edges. In much the same way, weathering at last reduces to rounded hills, the earth blocks cut by streams or formed in any other way. High mountains may at first be sculpted by the weather to savage peaks, but towards the end of their life history they wear down to rounded hills. The weather curve, which may be seen on the summits of low hills, is convex upward. The cooperation of various agencies in rock sculpture. For the sake of clearness, it is necessary to describe the work of each geological agent separately. We must not forget, however, that in nature, no agent works independently and alone, that every result is the outcome of a long chain of causes. Thus, in order that the mountain peak may be carved by the agents of disintegration, the waste must be rapidly removed. A work done by many agents, including some which we are yet to study, and in order that the waste may be removed as fast as formed, the region must first have been raised well above the level of the sea, so that the agents of transportation could do their work effectively. The sculpture of the rocks is accomplished only by the cooperation of many forces. The constant removal of waste from the surface by creep and wash and carriage by streams is of the highest importance, because it allows the destruction of the land by means of weathering to go on as long as any land remains above sea level. If waste were not removed, it would grow to be so thick as to protect the rock beneath from further weathering, and the processes of destruction which we have studied would be brought to an end. The very presence of the mantle of waste over the land proves that on the whole rocks weather more rapidly than their waste is removed. The destruction of the land is going on as fast as the waste can be carried away. We have now learned to see in the mantle of waste the record of the destructive action of the agencies of weathering on the rocks of the land surface. Similar records we shall find buried deeply among the rocks of the crust in old soils, and in rocks pitted and decayed, telling of old land surfaces long wasted by the weather. Ever since the dry land appeared, these agencies have, as now, quietly been unceasing at work upon it, and have ever been the chief means of the destruction of its rocks. The vast bulk of the stratified rocks of the Earth's crust is made up almost wholly of the waste thus worn from ancient lands. In studying the various geological agencies, we must remember in almost conceivable times in which they work. The slowest process, when multiplied by the immense time in which it is carried on, produces great results. The geologist looks upon the landforms of the Earth's surface as monuments, which record the slow action of weathering and other agents during the ages of the past. The mountain peak, the rounded hill, the wide plain which lies where hills and mountains once stood, tell clearly of the great results which slow processes will reach when given long time in which to do their work. We should accustom ourselves also to think of the results which weathering will sooner or later bring to pass. The tombstone and the boulder of the field, which each year lose from their surfaces a few crystalline grains, must in time be wholly destroyed. The hill, whose rocks are slowly rotting underneath a cover of waste, must become lower and lower as the centuries and millenniums come and go, and will finally disappear. Even the mountains are crumbling away continually, and therefore are but fleeting features of the landscape. And on that slightly melancholy note, I will call it a night. As always, if you'd like to pick up where we're leaving off, you can find The Elements of Geology on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Time Tales, a podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes will be released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week, but make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get your new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiko. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked in the show notes. Good night, and sweet dreams.